This is The Front Porch on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Shay Zeller. Soccer has been the most popular sport among immigrants in America for a long time. In 1950, a ragtag team of first-generation Americans were sent to represent the U.S. at the World Cup in Brazil. Most of the players came from one neighborhood in St. Louis called Dago Hill, where they played together their entire lives. The rest came from areas of New York and Philadelphia, where other sons of immigrants fell in love with the game. They had no time to prepare for the tournament, and no one, not even the players themselves, expected a great performance from the team. What they got was one of the greatest upsets in sports history. The U.S. team defeated the English against 500-1 odds. But the victory was largely ignored in the U.S. Most Americans had never heard of soccer at the time, and besides, the Red Scare was dominating the news pages, and the Korean War started the very next day. Jeffrey Douglas gives an account of the historic 1950 game in his book, The Game of Their Lives. The book was made into a movie last year, and we spoke with Jeffrey when the film was out in theaters. He set the scene for that 1950 match by reading the opening passage from his book.
The playing field wasn't much to look at or to play on. There would be reports later in the British press that it was a converted bull ring, but this couldn't have been so. They've never fought bulls in Brazil. Still, the grass was parched and patchy and far too high in spots. The ball, instead of settling, teed up unnaturally on the tufts. There were likely to be overkicks. The stands were of brick and timber, built a generation before the war. It was said that they groaned and swayed slightly when full, though it took only 30,000 to fill them, not the 50 or 60,000 that would be reported in the press. Even so, there wasn't an empty seat that day. The locker room was cramped, foul-smelling and cobweb-filled. The English had disdained them. They'd arrived already dressed. The Americans were less fussy. They'd seen worse. Of all of Brazil's major stadiums, this one was the humblest. Only first-round matches were to be played here, and only the least of those. The mismatches and the second-level games. In this case, a mismatch. The worst against the best.
Jeffrey Douglas reading from The Game of Their Lives, an account of the United States victory over England at the World Cup in 1950. Jeffrey, welcome to The Front Porch.
Well, thanks for having me, Shay. I enjoyed being here.
Thanks. So who was playing soccer back in the 1950s?
Basically, soccer in this country in the 50s was being played by two groups. One was the sons of first-generation Americans, the sons of immigrants, played it with inflated pig bladders that they picked up at the butcher store because they couldn't afford balls. And they would play it in the streets and kick against the sides of buildings, and doors became goals. That was how they learned. And the other group that played it was a group, a completely polar opposite group, which was sort of at prep schools.
We'll talk specifically about the players on this 1950 U.S. team, but it seems like it was mostly comprised of that first group, the group of first-generation Americans.
The team that I wrote about was almost entirely first-generation Americans. The good ones were recruited usually by local businesses. You had the Simpkins Ford Company, and they recruited a team, and then the Kudas Funeral Home recruited a team, and they paid enough money to give those guys jerseys, and they maybe paid them $5 a game, and they put them out on their local playground, and they had them play against each other, and they got fans in the hundreds. 200, 300, 400, 500 people would come out on a Sunday to see Kudas Funeral Home play Simpkins Ford, and that was pretty major local rivalry. That was the extent of it in this country. But some of those guys got really good. Some of these young guys were getting to be a whole lot better than anybody realized.
This is The Front Porch on New Hampshire Public Radio. My guest today is Jeffrey Douglas. His book, The Game of Their Lives, is about one of the greatest upsets in sports history, the U.S. victory over England as part of the 1950 World Cup. It seems like the odds against, at least with London bookers, I guess, the odds against the American team were pretty high, 500-1. And no one else came close to those odds. The other teams that were contenders had 12-1 or 3-1 odds. But 500-1, were they really that bad?
500-1 when you could get a bet down at all. I mean, the Americans in a lot of booking houses in London were not even, they were not even on the card. They were really a joke. I mean, you'd have to say, I think I said that at some point in the book, that they really were more of a joke than anything else. They were over there because of a fluke of the draw. They had, I think they had beaten Mexico once. Mexico was Cuba, I guess, once, and tied them another time. Cuba wasn't any good either, and been trounced by Mexico. And on the strength of that, they'd gotten in. They were given no chance at all of winning this game. I mean, it would be the example I give would be it would be as if 7 or 8 years ago, when the Dream Team went to the Olympics, remember that, the basketball, as if they had been beaten by Bermuda. I mean, that was sort of what we're talking about here.
Okay.
It just wasn't going to happen.
Well, they looked pretty haggard, too, when they walked out onto the field that day. I guess they had 12 days of traveling and a little bit of partying the night before.
Yeah, well, some of them went party. The movie made a little more of that than was probably true. But some of them did go out and sort of tie one on the night before. And there was a lot of plane over was pretty rough, I guess. And many of them, I think about half of them had never been in a plane before. One or two of them were terrified. They still hadn't gotten over it when they took the field. I mean, this was a very, very ragtag group of guys.
And they had only been playing together for a couple of months, right?
A couple of weeks. Yeah, three or four games, that's all.
So we know the outcome of that day. There was a huge upset. The United States team beat the English. But what happened? What went wrong for the English and obviously went right for the American team?
Well, I think that, first of all, the English didn't, because they didn't expect the outcome they got, and were thinking much in terms of that I've been talking in, which is the Americans were a joke, were just entirely confident of winning, to the point that they left their best player at home to rest up for the next match against Spain. And the rest of the team, I think, everyone expected a 6 or 8 or 10 goal, you know, margin. So they played with that kind of attitude. And the Americans, if you have nothing to lose, you play without self-consciousness, with efficient effort that isn't lost in sort of over-effort. And you're apt to play your best. And they did.
And the game took place in Brazil. How much of a factor was the Brazilian crowd?
Huge. The Brazilian crowd, the Brazilians, second to the English, were the favorites. The Brazilian and English teams were expected to meet in the finals of the World Cup that year. So the Brazilian crowd was obviously going to be rooting for anyone who played against England. But then, you know, when a few minutes went by and the Americans were playing surprisingly well, they began to get caught up in it, and they began to scream and began to get out of their seats, and the noise got louder in this little town, in this little stadium. And I think that carried the Americans along, too. So there were a lot of factors in that game.
There were certainly no Americans in the stands.
There was one. One American, a guy named, other than the team and the coach, there was one American, and his name was Dent McSkimming, and he was the only American journalist who covered the game in a journalist pool of several hundred. Some countries like Italy and Brazil, England, would send 15, 20 journalists. We sent one.
We're listening back to an interview with New Hampshire writer Jeffrey Douglas. His book, The Game of Their Lives, is about one of the greatest upsets in sports history, the U.S. victory over England at the 1950 World Cup of Soccer. He joined us last spring when the film adaptation of his book was out in theaters. I wanted to talk about a few of the players specifically on the team. We mentioned Harry Keough a little while ago and Frank Borghi. And to get into the details of Frank's life, if it weren't for soccer, he had other talents too. He could have had a career in baseball if it hadn't been for his mom.
Frank's a wonderful guy, first of all. Frank's a great, big, tall guy who smiles with just a perpetual smile on his face. He doesn't talk a lot. He's kind of shy. With enormous hands. I mean, you look at his hands, you can see why he was a goalie, why he was a keeper. But yes, he had tried out for a professional baseball. It would be a shortstop, and his mother wouldn't let him play. He said, Frankie's not going to play baseball. He's going to do something worthwhile with his life. He's not going to play baseball.
She wanted him to go to embalming school.
She wanted him to carry on the tradition of the Borghi funeral home, mm-hmm. which, sadly or not sadly, ultimately he did. But yeah, she wanted him to give up all this silliness, all these games he played, soccer and baseball. They just were not anything for a upstanding young first-generation Italian to do in the new country. He was going to make his way out here, and he was going to be a professional, and he wasn't going to play games. And he had to give up baseball, which really was his first love. And he did manage to talk his way into trying out for this soccer team and going down to Brazil and playing the World Cup. But even that was hard. mean, this is, they had very strong mothers, these young men, and fathers. I mean, their family was very strong. It really was a different world, mm-hmm. you know. When, as I say, which is what was a lot of the appeal for me in writing the book was that.
Yeah, I understand he played for some farm teams for a little while, and then somebody from the Dodgers or some other pro team came to his door.
That's right.
Recruiting him, and his mother basically
offered him a contract. I think it was $500 or something. And his mother said, "My Frankie's not going to play any games. My Frankie's going to be a professional person. He's going to be at a barber. He's going to go fix up dead people."
And that was it. He never played baseball again.
Never played baseball again. I mean, you did what your mother said, yeah. you know. And
even though he was an adult, he wasn't a child anymore.
Even though he was an adult, he was not a child. It was the greatest regret of his life. He would say that today, but he still would defend his mother for taking that route and forcing him to abandon his love.
There's another member of the team, Joe Gatchens, whose life also didn't take the easiest turn when he returned back from playing soccer. What happened to Joe?
Joe Gatchens is the saddest story of all the stories of that team. Joe Gatchens was the only Haitian on the team, and he was recruited from New York. He was a dishwasher in a New York City restaurant. And he was known as a brilliant but also very quirky player who did strange things on the field, like headstands. He just was a strange person. It's said that he practiced voodoo. He was a very eccentric guy. And Joe Gatchens, in a very quirky manner, scored the only goal in the game by heading in a ball that was shot from... that was kicked from the center of the field by Walter Barr, and no one today can really explain how he did it. He took an incredible leap, and the ball somehow touched some point of his head and was redirected into the goal. The goalie was standing there ready to catch it, and you can see in the only photo of that the goalie is still looking in one direction. The ball's going in behind him, because Joe Gatchens somehow got an atom of his forehead onto the ball and directed it into the goal for the only score. And Joe Gatchens was, after the game, some years, 3, 4, 5 years after the game, Joe Gatchens went back to Haiti, where he was a national hero. He coached kids' teams in Haiti. He was really, really loved. And he opened a dry cleaning business with his wife. And at the same time, his brother had been very vocal in his opposition to the Duvalier regime, which was a dictatorial regime in Haiti at the time, Papa Doc Duvalier. Joe was not a activist kind of guy at all. He's a very quirky, eccentric. He probably didn't know anything about politics. Didn't care. But his brother had left the country, and I believe was in the United States at the time. So the only retribution they could take was against Joe. And all that is known for sure is that one morning, some men with guns came to Joe's dry cleaning establishment, and took him away in a car, and he was never seen again. So that's the story of Joe Gatchens. Very sad. It was people tried. Actually, Pele, the great player, gave a benefit once at Shea Stadium in New York, or the Polo Grounds, one of the two, and trying to raise money to find out whatever happened to Joe Gatchens, because he was such a figure in the world of soccer, but no one ever found out.
Became one of the Haitian desperados.
Right. That's exactly what he was. Yeah.
This is The Front Porch on New Hampshire Public Radio. My guest today is Jeffrey Douglas. His book, The Game of Their Lives, is about one of the greatest upsets in sports history, the U.S. victory over England as part of the 1950 World Cup. There's a section of the book that involves both Borgi and Gatchens, and it's the final moment where the whistle blows and the United States is victorious, and I'd love to have you read that passage from the book.
I'd be happy to. It's one of my favorites. At the instant of the final whistle, the ball was in the air. Walter Barr, in the center circle, the closest man to it as it fell, caught it in his arms, then held on. He would keep it nearly 10 years. The crowd came over the side rails in waves, thousands strong. No one tried to stop them. Within not much more than a minute, you couldn't see the field. They had come for the Americans. They pummeled them, cheered them, hugged them, kissed them, draped some of them in flags. A small mob at one point, maybe 2 dozen men, slung Frank Borgi to their shoulders and paraded him like a trophy through the crowd. A minute later, another band hefted Joe Gatchens and did the same. There is a photo of that moment, the striker and the goalie, the first and last heroes of the day, aloft on the shoulders of a mob of worshipful strangers after an impossible victory in a foreign land at a foreigner's game. Borgie is spread-eagled, laughing crazily, draped over the bodies of his bearers like a too-long piece of bedding. Gaitchens is smiling, stuporously, like a shock victim or a man half asleep, half sitting, half lying, across the rubble of shoulders below. Both men look stricken. Both men look like boys.
Jeffrey Douglas, reading from The Game of Their Lives, The Untold Story of the World Cup's Biggest Upset. How are the lives of the other players when they returned? Did they come back to...
Exactly the same as when they left.
Okay.
The game changed nothing. Whereas today, something like that, you would be met at the airport and by screaming fans, and you would be driven down the street in an open limousine with people throwing confetti from buildings. It was nothing of that. They came back in different planes. They were met at the airport by their wives and girlfriends. They went back to work the next day. A lot of the people that they worked with and that they knew didn't even know where they'd been. So, no, we've been gone a while. Some of them, one or two of them, weren't even paid for the time they took off work. I mean, it was just like a non-event. And I think to some extent for a lot of years it was a non-event to them too. I mean, if you ask some of these players what's the most important game you ever played? What's the biggest game you ever played? They won't say this. They'll say,
really?
Oh, that was the game with Kutus. I was playing on Kutus and we beat Simpkins Ford on a Sunday and it was for the league championship and we had 500 in the stands and we won that game. And that was the biggest game. They didn't even realize what they'd done. They went down to Brazil and they beat the greatest team in the world in the most popular sport in the world. And yet some of them, most of them, would probably not have considered that a particularly significant moment in their soccer careers.
That was Jeffrey Douglas, author of The Game of Their Lives. It's an account of the U.S. upset over England during the 1950 World Cup of Soccer. He joined us on the front porch last spring when the film adaptation of his book was in theaters. This is the front porch on New Hampshire Public Radio.